Good evening, comrades. Thank you so much for the invitation. As the panel, the talk name said, about thinking and making some debates about the relationships between the mass movements and elections, I will try to make some points and some ideas of how is the current situation in Mexico around the election of López Obrador, not so much of what's happening now with the government and its chances. If you want to listen about that, I will do a couple of comments tomorrow in another talk. But here I want to focus on the issue of mass movements, elections, and the debates on the left around the past elections. The first thing that I want to say is, for making us all here more or less clear, in my point of view, Bernie Sanders is quite to the left in comparison to López Obrador. So you can give us an idea. There are many reasons why I can argue about that. For example, Sanders more or less has a speech around oligarchic debates that you can read in class coordinates, and López Obrador has not he's trying to build in his new government a kind of class consensus, even with one with the very traditional bourgeoisie Mexican. The other starting point I wanted to point is that López Obrador victories means for the Mexican politics the open of a total new period in our political history. That is now opening the chance of a construction of a new political regime. The previous regime that, in our opinion, is ending around the election, the campaign, and the first months of this new government, in our point of view, run between the 88 and the election in 2018. In this 30 years time, we had a very traditional oligarchic neoliberal regime with different parties, the PRI and the National Action Party. And in the whole period, with NAFTA and very strong privatizations and attacks to working class, etc., we also faced lots of mass struggles all around the country and all around this period. And starting to think a little bit about how to explain López Obrador's triumph, it cannot be understandable without taking into account these 30 years of mass struggles that in different ways were, how do you say, desgastando?
Exhausted.
Exhausting the previous regime as a factor that it finally breaks out. And also, an interesting issue is that except for three examples that happened in 2009 when the electricians' trade union were fired, 44,000 electricians were fired from one day to another, and it's a very important trade union struggle. The 2010 movement against war and violence and militarization all around the country, which in a movement which was called the Movement for Peace, Justice, and Dignity, and especially the 2014 movement for the live presentation of the students of Ayotzinapa, we had also five moments of great mass struggles that happened in electoral years. So there is an important relationship also between electoral periods and cycles and mass uprisings. Especially the previous regime, we say, it started in 88 with a huge fraud, that the cost was at least 500 of left-wing and socialist militant activists that were killed and some others disappeared, one member of our party, for example. So the new regime could enter. The second great moment, the 94 presidential elections and the uprising of the Zapatist movement in the South. The 99 and 2000, another presidential year with the huge strike of the students on the National University in defense of public education. 2006, the first time when AMLO ran for office, we have a huge mass struggle for defending the right to AMLO to get into the ballot, because there was a legal trick that the right wing tried to make so AMLO couldn't get to the election. But especially, we had the movement in Oaxaca, the national, the assembly, or the People's Popular Assembly of Oaxaca, which, in our point of view, if you want to have an idea of how socialism would look like, you need to go and look how far was the APO in 2006. The people and the movements and the trade unions in the control of public transport, media, and the streets and most of the core activities of the city. And finally, in 2012, the movement of that was called 1832, a movement against the imposition of the previous president, Enrique Peña Nieto. So in this last period, there's a very huge relationship between mass uprisings and elections. But this relationship is not like direct. I mean, in these cases that I have just broadly referenced to you, the main point of mass action is not directly linked to a concrete electoral campaign, except for a couple of issues. So, as I was saying, 2018 elections is a changing point in the Mexican politics, not in economics tendencies. And in this process, what López Obrador was able to build is kind of a new hegemony in which the social movements, and you can imagine all these people that were in streets around these 30 years and getting organized and fighting. Some of those, of these people, of course, most of them voted on the 1st of July, but they were not organically, in our point of view, being part of López Obrador party and movement and even campaigning. And even these social movements, or what those social movements brought after the mass uprising as organizational processes of long term, are not even part of this new great government pact. Except, for example, from the traditional peasant movement, but especially the quite bureaucratic and anti-democratic peasant organizations, also some kinds of neighborhood organizations. But one specific case, for example, is the case of the teachers' movement that even yesterday when Jesse and the CTU cameras were talking about was very impressive. I wanted to know that the Mexican teachers' movement is very thankful with the CTU and in general with the US teachers' movement because of their support in their time. The feminist movement and the eco-social movement, these are three key movements now in the country that are not only not part of the new regime, but they are all getting very quickly in contradiction. In the end, I will get back to that. But what we are facing now, that's important, I think, for some kind of relation reflection, is that after 30 years of huge mass struggle, we have a social space of many, possibly millions of people, with some kind of huge social and conscious radicalization. We cannot say because political culture, etc., are different that are exactly socialist, but maybe anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist conscious is more or less very huge in Mexican population, relatively, of course. But at the same time, and that explains in part the López Obrador triumph, now we are facing the building of a new relationship between the movements and the institutions. Of course, there are lots of people that have been part of left-wing traditions that are now in the government. So that means a change on how the government relationships with the movement. Because previously, the only possible answer was repression and repression and more repression. Now, the government is open the door, come on in, let's talk, let's try to get up to an agreement, etc. So one big topic now is how the social movement will get into this new relationship with the new government. Oh my God. Okay, so a few points about the socialist left and for here. We think that in this new government pact, the left in general, the socialist left, is outside of this pact. They are not part of it. Of course, there are, as I was saying, good people with very huge left-wing and socialist convictions that are part of the government now. They are trying to do their best in some cases, but they are not as a social force or as a political force. Morena, the López Obrador party, is more an electoral machine which is designed only for winning elections. And in that case, in our opinion, there's not a chance in the short term for trying to, maybe this comparison could be very forced, for having a kind of DSA inside Morena or something like that. We think there's not chance in this period. And but at the same time, because of these mass struggles all around the country, especially after 2014 and now with the eco-social movements of indigenous and peasant communities resisting to the mega projects, pipelines, dams, highways, trains, etc., that are managed to build, and the new feminist and quite radicalized side movement, those are two central actors that very difficultly can get under the control in this new relationship between state and government. So there is a social space, in our opinion, to try to figure out how can we build a political alternative to the left of the government, especially trying to think what López Obrador has made to win. He put winning as the unique goal, and in his way, and in the way of winning, he gave lots of concessions, and including lots of traditional politics into his government. So what does winning mean, for example, and what's the price for it? And finally, because I have not much time, I think we have always think, when we get to elections debates between socialists, which is the real relationship of forces, these kind of movements, and what's the best way, without having any answer before thinking about, to getting, or not getting, depends, elections as a way to build, especially, political projects that are clearly identified with anti-capitalist, socialist, and working class tradition and our own spaces and parties. And thank you.
Hello, good afternoon. So in terms of electoral politics, I come from Anticapitalistas, the Spanish section of the Fourth International, and we have been part of the Podemos movement. Our first electoral experience, or at least since I joined the organization, we were another organization back in the 70s, and then we had other experiences. But in terms of our recent organization, when we constituted ourselves as anti-capitalist left in 2014, we did it through an electoral campaign, actually. It was the campaign for the 2014 European elections. They happened to be an elections where which tend to be quite ideological. People don't really see the importance of or the power of the European Parliament, because in fact doesn't have much power. So it's a good moment where you can present a new force and try to run a campaign on very strong political terms and not so much on conquering power. And at that time we thought it was a good moment to, through a campaign for the European elections, present our organization publicly, try to build new groups and collectives in different cities, and sort of train ourselves to run a campaign nationally. So we were very conscious that our aim was not to win the election, or we would not win an MEP, but actually the result we got was 20,000 votes. I must say that we were disappointed on that side. We didn't get as wide as an appeal as we would wish. Still, it was a useful campaign, and I think we wouldn't be where we are now if we hadn't had that campaign at some that point. So I mention this because it's one way to approach electoral politics that at some points we might be needing to do it. Use the moment where there's an election just to talk politics around you, make yourself known, discuss, and so on, even if you don't have the means or the strength to win an election. Since then, many things have happened, and as a fourth international, we have been promoting the idea of building broad anti-capitalist parties, and we have been more or less successful in different European countries on building this. So the idea that there was a general crisis of the traditional political parties, that the social democrat parties had lost much of their appeal to the working class, and through their neoliberal policies they were not able to embody a left perspective anymore, and therefore the idea that there was space to build new forces which brought in radical ideas and were able to organize broadly and also contest elections. This was sort of our hypothesis, and I think it has been more or less confirmed, for instance, by the experience of the Bloco de Esquerda in Portugal, which is a coalition of different Marxist groups, or the rise of Podemos in Spain, very famously, which has been a new force which has really shaken the political landscape. And all these forces were built through electoral campaigns. But further than that, we've also had, our debates on how to approach electoral politics were very much influenced by the Latin American experiences. I guess that must be, to a certain extent here, also the case, that the fact that we had the Venezuelan government, the Bolivian government, the Ecuadorian government, who were defending a sort of anti-imperialist, anti-neoliberal, sometimes socialist perspective, and the fact that they had won the government through elections, at least it sparked some discussions. And when we launched Podemos, I think that the different actors, we all had different understandings of what the Latin American experiences meant and to which extent they were an example to follow or not, and we have been more critical of many of these experiences, even if supportive, but at least they showed they allowed us to imagine the idea of actually contesting elections to win and having a popular movement to build an electoral force which aims to build to win the election and to win the government. This is not to say that we had abandoned our revolutionary strategy for a purely reformist one, but our hypothesis was that it was possible to bring to government a force with an anti-austerity program, a program that would inevitably lead to a clash with the European Union and with the neoliberal dictates of the European Union, and this could favor a process of mobilization and radicalization which would allow us to push forward. So we have not been naive about the fact that just by getting to power through elections we would be able to transform society, but we did think that such a situation allow us to go forward in the class struggle, bring forward consciousness, and contribute to mass mobilization and so on. This was sort of our hypothesis, and we have, I think, we have been able to test it out in the recent years, and most importantly, the experience of Syriza in Greece has allowed us to put this to a test. And in my view, what happened in Greece, in a way, it confirms that it was possible to reach the government with an anti-austerity program, and that there was a political moment which allowed for that, given the right circumstances. But also, it showed us all the mistakes and the should nots and the things we should not do and that we should avoid if such a situation came to play. So we supported the Syriza government in the first months, even if comrades who were within Syriza already told us that there were very worrying orientations from the Tsipras government. We visited Greece many times. I was working in the European Parliament with Miguel Urban, and we visited Athens several times to meet with the comrades from the revolutionary left in Greece and to participate in different self-organized initiatives around the new government and so on. But we also followed closely the negotiations with the European Union. And then I think that what happened with Varoufakis negotiating with the European Union institutions and so on. On the one side, it was a good performance of a sort of clash, political clash between the elected government with an anti-austerity program and the European institutions. And in a way, it was pedagogical for many people to see this this clash. On the other side, it is clear that the Greek government didn't take the necessary measures to be able to really do a real negotiation with the European Union. In fact, they abandoned from the start any idea of doing any unilateral action because they didn't want to provocate the European Union. So they continue, most importantly, paying the debt to the IMF and to the European Central Bank and so on. Whereas at the same time, the European Union stopped any payments to Greece and did engage in a whole series of unilateral actions against the Greek state, which in fact led to the the Greek government was put into a corner. They were completely cut off financiation and in the end surrendered and betrayed the program for which they were elected. So. In terms of strategy, we think that a government, we still consider the idea that there could be an anti-austerity policy government within the European Union, but for sure, if that was to happen, it would need to take a whole series of measures in terms of suspending the debt payments, taking capital control, socializing the financial sector and so on, that would allow it to actually negotiate or to have a forced position with the European institutions. But more importantly than this, in terms of mass mobilization, we understand that such a struggle could only go forward with mass mobilization. And I do think that the Greek case showed that such a situation would allow for would put the conditions for mass mobilization and self-organization. In fact, when Tsipras called for a referendum on whether they should adopt the memorandum proposed by the European Union or not, so just yet another neoliberal plan, the mobilizations that were done to reject the referendum, the memorandum, were much wider than what Tsipras had expected. Actually, it does seem that Tsipras was expecting to lose that referendum. So he was calling to reject, but at the same time he was expecting that people would be too scared to reject this neoliberal plan from the European Union. And in fact, the opposite happened. There was a huge, they say, the biggest mobilization in recent Greek history of people that even if they were subject to the blackmail of the European institutions, were ready to reject this plan and push forward for a radical change of the Greek economy and a break with the neoliberal institutions. So the Greek government betrayed that movement and did exactly the opposite of what the referendum called for, but it does show the allow us to think of a process of breaking with the neoliberal institutions and building a kind of new socialist regime in one of our countries. So those are the lessons we draw, and I think they are some of the most important recent strategic lessons we have. Just to finish, one last thing that I think is relevant for the discussion on electoral policies is the experience we've had in the local governments in Spain. In 2015, many local governments were won by popular ballots that were constituted by a coalition of Podemos together with other left-wing and social movements, and we were able to win the governments of Madrid, Barcelona, Cádiz. Cádiz was won by The mayor of Cadiz is a comrade of ours from Anticapitalistas, and it is in fact the only of these towns that has maintained this government since the recent election now in 2019. So we have lost Madrid and Barcelona, but we have kept Cádiz, which is also the only, actually, Podemos mayor was also an anti-capitalist mayor, and we do keep that. And it has shown us the possibility, and I think that's something that you may know something about in the United States, of locally running elections by first building coalitions of which bring together different perspectives and different people who are actually active on the ground and active on the city, and by being able to build an appealing candidates and so on, and being able to spark a process of mobilization to change the ruling person in the town, it is possible to win this kind of elections. I have to finish that the balance sheet of these governments again is mixed, and the truth is that we have been defeated in this last year, but there are many useful lessons on what should be done and what should not. And the same issue that we've had with the Syriza government in Greece, I think we've had in many cases on a smaller scale in the local government. Is the local government ready to disobey and to go forward and to confront the national government and the European Union basing itself in its democracy, democratic legitimacy, and on mass mobilization, and on taking measures that allow them to maintain popular support, or are they going to submit to the ruling classes and the ruling governments? And this, in many cases, has been the main factor in terms of their success or defeat.
Thank you so much. So I just want to do a reminder of my last talk. So I'm political director of Our Revolution, which is a Sanders-inspired nonprofit, but I'm here on my own accord, so my analysis will be speaking more as myself, less in my political role, but it'll obviously influence me in what I say here. So I think when we were preparing for this talk, one kind of general similarity we noted among the three different countries was that each kind of presented a kind of political figure, so like Sanders, Iglesias, and AMLO, who kind of come from the socialist movements, are of the left, but don't have any necessarily formal accountability to a varying degree. So that would be different than I think other historical examples we could give, where a leader or leaders have much more of are much more formally tied to a specific organization or movement, and can be kind of, you know, for lack of a better term, with recalled by them, replaced. So what, and kind of how do you make about what do we make of this in our each historical circumstances? So kind of to summarize my points about Sanders and the United States is, like, you know, we kind of, and I'll walk through some of these points in as I go on. So I kind of view Sanders as a creation of the socialist movement or U.S. socialist history, but not beholden to it in any formal sense, in the same way the other two historic leaders are. His stances can be moved by social movements. In fact, I would argue that's the only real mechanism to change his public positions or how he acts as a political actor. And how socialists engage and strategize with said social movements is the key question to how we deal with both a potential presidency or a primary defeat and whomever kind of takes the White House from there. So I thought it would be good to kind of do some historical kind of how did Sanders get here, not how did we get here. So I think it's important to remember that Sanders, you know, was part of an organization despite his kind of historic or reputation as an independent now. He was a member of the Young People's Socialist League when he was a student in the city. So that was an organization that was the youth wing of the Socialist Party of America. And he, specifically the time in which he was in that formation was really when I think very clearly that political formation was in kind of an irreversible decline. The Socialist Party never kind of took off, even during the emergence of the New Left. It kind of but we're not, and I won't go into too much details about that, but I think that there's kind of tendencies that you can see what that he developed from there, and I think they're kind of mirror a term I won't go into too much, but it kind of reminds me of, like, kind of in his own way, he's still a Shackmanite. And in that way, I kind of see as, like, there's very much a fierce loyalty to labor leadership, you know, and I think that he genuinely takes positions and views kind of trade unions as they're formed today. I'm not even saying it like a normative sense of what they could be, as like representatives of the working class and what working people are their best interests. So I mean, he'll take, you know, if you look at his position with immigration, it could largely mirror what's the AFL's position of that period, you know. And I think so, it's just something to kind of put in context. I think he also in that political tradition, like, is, you know, I would say my spin is very anti-totalitarian and kind of like really doesn't view, you know, I think, you know, what some people would call real existing socialism as socialism. You know, I think he's shifted as coming away, but I think he definitely comes from a, you know, you can see that third camp kind of like neither Moscow nor United States, at least in his formation. Whether we can get into more of the nuances in the discussion, you guys can talk, but I think you can see that there. And I do think that in both actual and rhetorical way, there is a commitment in some way to independent political action. And I'll go into that in a little bit. But I think you see kind of a split and between Sanders and historic Democratic Socialists of America around, you know, in the way, I'm in the last point, in the independent political action. I think I remember even hearing, I have no way to verify this, but I've heard it, is that, you know, that one of DSA's predecessor organizations, the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee in Vermont, didn't even support Sanders initially because he wasn't a Democrat, you know, and he was running as an independent, you know, and it wasn't part of the historic strategy to support Democrats from the left. And I think that's also when people ask, what's Sanders' historic relationship with DSA? It's always good to remember all politics is local, and people remember who had their initial back. So you see that, and so Sanders has, you know, dedicated a lot of time in Vermont to things like the Liberty Union Party, and helping form the Progressive Party. So doing kind of independent of the Democratic Party politics, but still like working with the Democrats. It's still like getting nominated by them eventually, and becoming active in the party. So you see this kind of interesting kind of struggle going on, for lack of a better term, where Bernie Sanders will both simultaneously not be, you know, still be call himself an independent, but then be work through our revolution, be really pushing people to join their local Democratic parties, make them better, make them more accountable. And then one of his huge projects that a lot of people, you know, was not on the tip of the tongues of a lot of people because it was total inside baseball, but it was something I dedicated a lot of my staff time to, was the Union Reform Commission, which were some key Democratic Party internal reforms, like getting rid of superdelegates from the first ballot, which was something that, like, our revolution and lots of other groups, you know, spent a lot of time. But these were literally meeting, but we would spend time, like, together at Democratic National Committee quarterly meetings. They're not like, these were not mass participation folks, but it shows he has this interesting kind of tension where he both wants to maintain independence, but then is having his organization spending significant time doing the kind of Roberts Rules-esque level Democratic Party inside baseball. And I think it kind of reflects, you know, his time in Congress and how he's evolved. From being a mayor, you know, who both was somebody who totally came out of nowhere from the outside, but then learned how to, like, kind of work with the existing political players. And even in his newest book, he says, like, I probably wouldn't have been mayor if the police union hadn't endorsed me, you know, at the very last minute. You know, he won by 12 votes, so it was like probably 14 cops, you know, changing their opinions in Burlington could have swung the election. So it's that, once again, it's that tension, and you see, like, but there was a genuine commitment to kind of basic social democracy. So I was, like, looking back at some of the things he did. Like, I mean, one of his main priorities as mayor in his first term is, like, fighting the luxury housing. Like, people want to build luxury housing, they want to push out poor people. He's like, over my dead body. And he really stood by in the real, because like in New York City where I come from now, it's like real estate really is the huge power of capital in the city like that, because it's not manufacturing, it's not other elements. And he really also did things like they were nice, like, you know, promoting worker ownership of like through co-ops, you know, just genuinely like good things that you would expect a democratic socialist to do within a short period of time. And then he's kind of still continued this kind of social democratic policies in the states, in Capitol Hill. So when he became a congressperson, he worked with a guy, Ron Dellums, who passed away recently, but was a DSA vice chair, was a lifelong member of DSA, and they were the co-chairs of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. So you see these two socialists kind of come together and kind of work to form a social democratic bloc. The efficacy of the Progressive Caucus is a longer conversation, but it's interesting that he's still like trying to build these institutions that at least represent broadly a challenge to the establishment of the Democratic Party or other institutions. And since then, he's been one of two senators to be in the Congressional Progressive Caucus. The other was Paul Wellstone, who passed away some time ago from Minnesota. And he's used his platform, because he's largely been in the minority, you know, to advance demands of social movements. So you see like Fight for Fifth. So like Mike, the new executive director of Our Revolution, comes from Good Jobs Nation, which did a lot of work around federal contracts. And he said like Sanders was the only one there from the Senate who would come to anything about raising federal contractors' wages, which is totally controlled by the presidency. So it's not like this is like something that the state didn't have any power over. And like he was the only one really. But then there's everything most people here would know, but it's worth repeating, you know, College for All, Medicare for All, and most recently, I think very importantly, like the anti-war in Yemen and really working to fight that. And I think like it's important to see, to put into context, like his rise also with other political context. And I think that you look at, you know, and Obama kind of not only being in Chicago, but Obama is a huge part of in the background of Sanders' rise, not because of any direct relationship they have, but I think what a couple of critical elements. One is like the and it's not a unique argument to me, the anti-socialism against Obama backfired. And especially with people my generation, a little younger, Obama was very popular, like, oh, if he's a socialist, maybe socialism has been so bad. And then you have, and then Obama, and I was rereading some of Sanders' work, and he kind of complains that he really saw, like many Americans, saw a lot of promise in Obama he's like, what happened to candidate Obama? What happened to the guy who like used social movement rhetoric? And during the financial crisis, you know, you have things like Occupy, especially you give kind of a language to what Sanders is doing, and he's able to use that and articulate it back. So it's like, and so you very much see that Sanders is like both reflecting the movements but also benefits from the kind of way they've changed the popular discourse, and then enables him to reach a much broader audience, not saying the same things he's always said, but using new slogans. And so I think there is a grain of truth to what a friend said, who once said Sanders is popular because socialism is popular. And I think that it's not fully true, but it's a good axiom to think about how these two kind of both the rise of why we have 1,000 to 1,500 people here at the DSA convention a month is not coincidental to why Sanders is also popular. He's not, and I wouldn't say he's the catalyst of that. I think they're connected. So you see in his campaign, you largely see, you know, him pushing these ideas. And then I think it's the one thing I would like kind of conclude on, because I'm running short on time, is that we used to, and I'm glad Michael Leidy's here, who has helped me plan these, we used to have People Summit meetings in McCormick for a couple of years, which brought together what I would describe as the organization supporting Sanders, like DSA, National Nurses United, Progressive Democrats of America, and groups that would have if they weren't charity organizations like United Students Against Sweatshops. And it kind of gave a space for lots of activists to meet, work together, and build. And I think that's really helped. And because by him being that symbolic figure, it gave political and organizing space for people to meet, who have since gone on to keep continuing to working together. So NNU still primarily heads it up, but it's been increasingly larger table, like by that I mean coalition around Medicare for All, including DSA doing, but Our Revolution as well, doing lots of mass work. You see that you know, folks, now people, he can kind of hand that off to like Pramila Jayapal, who's from Washington, in Congress, who can really lead the fight. There's just so much more dynamism around these fights that he can kind of take a step back and let other people take over. And so I think it's like kind of what it demonstrates to me is four points. One is that socialists need electeds to push legislation, but we need active movements around those people. I think, I would hope, at the conclusion of this, people see that none of us think electing people, especially here, is enough. It's very much, that's just even like just a minor step in actual social change. When socialists hold power, it's good to have some unity around the movements around the electoral process. But we still face serious constraints around bourgeois democratic or undemocratic institutions such as the Senate. So it's very critical then, you know, to win some elections on the ground, especially municipally, but really force and really make demands that hold anyone we elect accountable and build power from there. So I'll yield my time back to Todd, but thank you so much.